This is the Better Reading Podcast platform with stories behind the story, Jane's Be Better podcast, My Book Chat with Caroline Overington, and more. Looking for a particular podcast? Remember, you can always skip to it.
Welcome to the Better Reading Podcast, Stories Behind the Story, brought to you by Belinda Audio. Listen to Belinda audiobooks anywhere, everywhere.
Hi, this is Cheryl Arkell from the Better Reading Podcast, Stories Behind the Story. We talk to authors about how they came to tell us their story. Jess McGeckin, welcome to Better Reading.
Thank you very much for having me.
Wow. We don't often have authors and illustrators, so I'm really looking forward to this chat. Jess is an author, as I said, and an illustrator of picture books and nonfiction, who is inspired by the natural world and who loves crafting stories full of hidden details that the reader can keep finding well after the first look. They're like Where's Wally, but nature books, aren't they?
That's a good description. Yeah, that's a very good description.
His recent picture book, Deep, is an illustrated nonfiction book that explores the hardest places to reach, from the molten depths of our planet to the frigid depths of our outer space. It also won the 2023 Children's Book Council of Australia Eve Pownall Award. The highly anticipated follow-up, High, was released earlier this year, with the third book in the series, Lost, coming out next year. Okay, so explain each one to me and explain the concepts.
Sure. So they're definitely designed to work both independently as books, but also as a series. So the first book in the series is called Deep. And what I really wanted to do was explore those kind of like amazing hidden worlds that are still on our Earth and kind of in the universe. So things like the depths of the ocean and kind of the black holes. And I really wanted kind of a just to use that phrasing or that word deep as an excuse to explore these places that we still know so little about. And I should say that I work at the museum and I get to kind of talk to scientists every day. And part of the beauty of that is they'll often tell you that there's so much that they don't know rather than what they do know. So deep was really just an excuse to kind of, you know, ask lots of questions and not answer all of them just because.
Do you know what I'm often surprised at, and excuse me to interrupt,
no,
is
not
how
at all.
Many living creatures we actually don't know about, that there we're always discovering something, a creature that is completely new to us.
Absolutely. It's incredible. Yeah. And just in all the books, and especially the last one, Lost, which we'll come to in a moment, that's a real underlying theme is there's so much to protect that we know about, but there's so much to protect that we don't even know about as well.
Yeah.
So Deep really sort of sets up the series by, you know, asking questions about what we don't know and kind of thinking about those hidden worlds, deep in the ocean, deep in the forest, and even deep underground, sort of fossils and deep under our cities. The second book in the series is called High, and that kind of takes a new perspective look at some of the worlds above our heads. So I had a lot of fun with that one, looking at things like animals that live high in the canopy of the forest, looking at things like tall trees, looking at flyers and birds and humans who have gone into flight for the first time. But then looking even broader than that, sort of at the layers of our world and our atmosphere, and then kind of all the way into out of space to think about some of the, you know, the things that are orbiting our heads all the time. And of course, High is also a nice way of talking about the impacts that we've had on our climate and our atmosphere, because when you start to sort of look at, take a bird's eye view of things, you can really, you know, assess just the impact that we've had on our little planet.
Can I interrupt you there?
Yeah, again, please, please, yes.
Kookaburras.
Kookaburras.
Right? Yeah, kookaburras. So if you follow me on Instagram, you'll know I'm obsessed. My apartment is in a park and it attracts all sorts of birds, but mainly kookaburras, right? And I don't know what it is about those birds. I really don't, but I am totally obsessed with how they look, their sounds they make. And maybe it's because I was singing, you know, when I was little, kookaburra sits in an old gum tree. But also they wake up at about 4 a.m. and they start you know, all of them. I think we've got at least 20 or 30 in the park and they're all laughing at the same time. That doesn't bother me at all. I mean, it actually gives me great joy and I hear it every morning. But when people stay with me, particularly guests from overseas, they just can't get their head around that bird. Why has it maintained the love, the affection, you know, because there's hundreds of birds, but why is it in Australia or particularly, I don't know whether it's New South Wales or Victoria, but that the kookaburra is still well-loved and even though it's quite common?
That's a great question. And I think it's that song that it sings. And this, you know, themes kind of came out throughout all of the books, and singing and the way that we tell stories to each other is a big theme that kept coming up. Looking at history, and I think, you know, animals certainly do that, telling stories to each other and to us. So I think the idea that either that they're laughing at us or maybe with us, I think endears us to them or them to us perhaps. So song and, you know, because really picture books are just songs.
They're rhymes.
Pictures. So that would be, I think the animals that we can talk to and sing with are the ones that stay very close to us.
Yeah. And so we've talked about High, Lost. Yep. Tell me about Lost.
So Lost is really exciting. And I just got a copy of the podcast,
but
I
really got
a copy of the post yesterday for the first time, which is.
Oh, it's beautiful.
All writers and illustrators will know that that's the most terrifying and wonderful moment when you get a copy of your book for the first time. So Lost is a bit of a time traveling adventure, and it takes everything that we've learned from Deep and High and really kind of looks at things that have come before and why things come and go on our planet. So Lost looks at things like dinosaurs and why these amazing giant creatures came and left our planet or were, you know, what caused their extinction. Looking at things like the megafauna that came afterwards and humans that came along. And then really taking that framing of Lost and playing with the idea of things like camouflage, like maybe being lost in the wild is a good place to be. And then there's the impact that we've had on creatures around us as well and those that we as humans have caused to be lost forever through things like extinction. So this is really bringing it together and hopefully with a really hopeful end as well. The end of this book looks at things like rewilding and those kind of really hopeful stories of things that we thought we'd lost forever, but really we haven't. So it kind of finishes where Deep started in that it still asks a lot of questions that it doesn't answer, but hopefully it does so in a way that will leave a lot of questions to be kind of researched and thought of by the reader.
I think you'll like this. I've got a great nephew who I look after one day a week and I've talked about him a lot on this podcast, but just a couple of weeks ago, he's 10, right? A couple of weeks ago, he said
great
to
age.
Me, yeah, he's a great age. And I always sit with him. We eat together so that I feel as though that's a really good time to get conversation out of any child, particularly 10-year-old. Anyway, he declared, you know, we're just eating our steak or whatever we were eating. And he said, Cheryl, I believe in God. I said, oh, okay. Yeah, great. That's interesting. And he said, but I don't believe in Adam and Eve. I don't believe that. I said, oh, okay. He said, I believe in evolution. I said, oh, okay. He said, because sometimes I feel like I'm a monkey.
that's as good as explanation as anything.
Don't you think?
He knows
where he came from.
I do.
I love the trajectory of that story, right? It was fantastic.
Oh, that's great. And that's what I think illustrated books can do so well is
illustrate it to kids. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, often when I'm reading my books to schools, you know, there's monkeys in a lot of these books. There's definitely monkeys in Deep. but the first thing that, you know, I'll show it to them and be like, you know, what looks familiar about these animals? And inevitably they'll say one of them looks like their brother or sister. Or one of their teachers, which is I definitely don't encourage, but always get
people. That's right. And also it's not an insult.
It's no, not at all.
No, they love animals so much. It's not an insult. The other thing we do is we talk about our favourite animals in a hierarchy, like which one comes first, which one comes second and whatever. Elephants is number one for me and dogs are number two. And I love that. I love the fact that we're talking about nature. He does think I'm a little obsessed with the kookaburras in the park, but I am. But how important is that for kids, just to be totally aware of what's happening around them in terms of animals?
I think inherently they're much more aware of it than we are as adults.
Aren't they?
Yeah, I think it's something that we actually grow out of a little bit as we get older. You know, we get busy and we don't.
We stop looking.
We stop looking, exactly. And so I think the most important thing for kids is just to hold on to it for as long as possible and be reminded that it's not, you know, you can enjoy this and keep hold of that as you grow up, and you can use it to inspire you in your job and in your hobbies, and to protect it. So I think really my job as an author and illustrator writing about nature is just to kind of, you know, just to keep nurturing them and keep asking them questions, which we might not have the answers for. So I think it's so important, and it gives us, especially now when things are pretty dire in the natural world, to kind of remind all readers, but especially kids, how much amazing stuff is out there that
and
we
how
don't
precious know, it is.
How precious it is too, because it gives us more meaning as humans to know that there's things out there surviving and living much better than we ever could. And it fills me with a lot of hope to see the things that have survived for so long without us.
Okay, so tell me your career path, your trajectory, like, you know, how it is that you came to where you're at now. Go as far back as you, as your influences go.
Sure. So it's one of those funny paths that makes a lot of sense in retrospect, but at the time probably didn't. So I'm really lucky in that I grew up with a family of artists around me and really strong, incredible female role models, especially. So my grandma was an artist and did beautiful oil paintings. My mother is an artist and a scientific illustrator. So when she worked at the old Melbourne Museum for many years, and she still does actually, as a scientific illustrator, which is, for those who don't know it, an amazing job that, you know, when cameras can't do everything, illustrators come in and draw these specimens that can't be captured in the same detail. So I kind of grew up in this house that was filled with like weird kind of like animals and jars that she'd taken home. I got to go and visit the museum a lot as a kid, like in the basement where they kept the scientists and the specimens. And that's definitely kind of like, you know, inherently in my DNA somewhere. So I was always encouraged to draw as a kid, and to not do it necessarily as something that was just to do it for pleasure, not just for the sake of doing it, to document something. So yeah, I grew up and I did a lot of art at school, but I did more kind of it was time to decide what to do after school. I actually leant towards graphic design rather than art, which I'm really glad I did, because it gave me a foundation in art as a tool rather than just, you know, there's a lot of pleasure in it, but it kind of made me understand that creativity is something that you can actually switch on and off, and that you can, you know, if you stick with it.
And I think with graphic design, it gives you kind of a discipline, that it's structured, right? And so that when you go to do freestyle illustration or other, you've got the basis, I think, you know, you've got a kind of starting point, if you like.
Absolutely, because it's all about communication, and you don't always get to communicate your own ideas, which is a really handy skill to have. Because as a, you know, as an author and an illustrator, you're working as part of a team, and you've got to take advice from other people. And graphic design teaches you to be very good with taking on feedback, but just the feedback that you want to take on. You know, so kind of. I still work as a designer in my day job, but I kind of chipped away at design for quite a few years, and then kind of picked up illustration again, which was something I hadn't done for a little while. But I had an opportunity to, me and my partner lived overseas for a couple of years in Oxford, which was amazing.
Wow.
Yeah, because she's a medieval historian, which is a whole other story.
You too.
It just gave me the space.
When you both introduce yourself at a dinner party.
Yeah, pretty much. A picture book author, an illustrator, medieval.
Yeah. And people are like, oh, what?
Exactly. But it was just an opportunity to have space away from things to kind of practice something that I wanted to. And for me, that was writing books. And because I didn't know how to go about finding an illustrator or an author, I just kind of did both at the same time and practiced both those skills together, and was lucky enough to, when I came back to Australia, to get a publishing
So was that the first book, or did you illustrate something else before?
No, so that was I've kind of alongside the nonfiction, I've done some fiction picture books as well. Yeah. So that the first book that I had was a picture story book called Fly, and I've had a number of those with a fantastic publisher in Puffin.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
They're not dissimilar to the nonfiction either. They've definitely got those elements woven through them, but it's just another kind of trajectory of that path, I suppose.
And very often you get an author and an illustrator, and you know, particularly with picture books, and they're usually two different people, right? So you've got somebody who writes the words and somebody who draws the illustration, but you're doing both. And tell me how the writing came to you.
The writing, to be honest, was a bit harder than the illustration, I think, because it had less practice at it. But I think to see them as actually skills that are pretty similar was quite helpful for me. So to realize that actually when you're writing, all you're doing is painting a picture without paintbrushes. So to kind of, and especially nonfiction, people don't respond necessarily to dry facts. So when I was writing, especially these books, I wanted to find a language that was a little bit more how like we talk to each other. It was something a bit more conversation and a little bit more kind of, there's some humor in it and some kind of a lot of analogies. So for me, the writing, it was really a way of bringing the illustrations to life and kind of just another layer of the artwork, really.
Mm. And were you inspired as a child? Were you inspired by people like Graham Bass, Morris Sendak?
Yes, very much so. They're all names very high on the list of inspiration, especially Graham Bass. I think, you know, we spoke a little bit about those kind of hidden Where's Wally details, and he was one of the first, well, not one of the first, but maybe one of the definitely prominent illustrators that I grew up with that was doing that so well. Just hidden layers of meaning everywhere and things to find and really giving value to those pages more so than others might have been doing.
I love, you know, and people who listen to this podcast will know this, I love picture books so much, and I talk about it often, and I still read a lot of picture books because I find that it is such a powerful tool when it works in terms of storytelling. So few words, but and also sometimes I think, do the words stand alone without the illustration, because they come so hand in hand, if you like. One of my favorite books, and I've talked about this a lot, is John Brown Rose and the Midnight Cat by Jenny Wagner. Do you know that book?
I do. It's beautiful.
Isn't that beautiful? Well, I've got a dog called John Brown. He's 17, actually. Oh. But that book is so powerful on so many levels, but the illustrations are so powerful.
Mm. And I think, to answer your question, I certainly think the illustrations can stand up without the text sometimes. The text without the illustrations, I don't know if they can in that format. I think they need the space around them to work.
I agree.
Well, often I find when I'm, you know, the very last kind of round that I do when I'm writing and illustrating books is not adding things, it's taking things away that you don't need anymore. And Deep is a great, classically, these nonfiction books have been filled with so much information, and I really wanted to leave at least a couple of spreads in each of them where there's just kind of space for it to breathe, because I think that's so important to leave moments of silence and breathing space, you know, like pauses between sentences and paragraphs.
Yeah. Now, I don't know very much about literacy at all, and I don't know very much about learning to read. No, did you? But when I see children now, because I've got lots of great nieces and nephews, and they just love devour books, but they're telling the story very often. It's been read to them. Right. And you would have seen this. It's been read to them. They can't read. Let's say they're two or three. I've got a two-year-old who's crazy about books and I see him reading. And he is following that illustration and telling the words.
And that's how we learn, isn't it? We watch people and faces and landscapes and that's, you know, that's a greater skill, I think, in some ways than reading is just giving words to those pictures. But I think, yeah, we learn through memorizing pictures first and foremost in everything we do.
Yeah, yeah, it's so lovely to watch. So you became a graphic designer, all right, and then tell me what, so you started working at the museum. How did you get there and what's your job at the museum?
I did. So I work as a graphic designer for the museum. So we've got a team of designers that works on our exhibitions and all of the other stuff that comes along with a museum. So updating labels and creating signage and maps and things like that, which was an amazing job that I sort of fell into, not through any connection to my mum or any of her past, but it was just an amazing job that happened to come up, which I got, which was great. And yeah, alongside that, also just developing a way of communicating my own ideas in the form of picture books around nature and the world around us, I suppose, which has, kind of led me to these wonderful nonfiction books, which I've really, really enjoyed.
So do you think your job, Jess, inspired you to write these picture books, these nonfiction picture books, like what you do during the day?
I'm sure on some level it has, but I think the people around me at that job inspire me more than the job itself. I think just knowing how many people there are that study these amazing niche things takes the pressure off me having to learn them, you know, off by heart, because it means that I can kind of just ask questions and I guess being surrounded by these, and I don't think they'd be offended.
It's like your reference library, isn't it? It's right.
Exactly.
There.
And that's not exclusive to me working there. It's anybody can contact these people and visit these places. And I think realizing that there's the vast, vast majority of people don't mind being asked about their knowledge base was a real turning point, because I let that fear of asking people questions kind of went away, and that kind of just joy of bringing up conversations with people and saying, what do you know about this, kind of came to the fore.
And I'm sure that everybody wants to tell you what they know.
Everybody loves to talk about what they know.
Everyone. Okay, so I've got another question for you. So I talk very often to fiction writers, and a lot of people write historical fiction. And one of the things that I hear a lot from fiction authors is the balance between research and story, you know. And that would apply to you, wouldn't it? Like, how much research do you do before you take pen to paper?
It's a good question. As much as I can,
yeah.
But with the caveat that not all research is created equal, I think, in terms of, and again, this is where, in one of those amazing connections that has been so helpful, having a partner who studies history and is a you know, historian in her own right, she will tell me that, you know, those primary source pieces of evidence are the most important things. So to kind of question the sources of what you're reading as well. And so that's really helped to kind of make sure that I'm doing research, but I'm doing the right research. So I'm not necessarily looking for something told in other people's words. I'm looking for those actual sources of how we know these pieces of information, if that makes sense. So things like...
Oh, that makes so much sense, because I do that a lot on social media. I'm very active on social media, particularly Instagram. And at the moment, in the current world that we're living, I'm sharing a lot of stories about what's happening in Palestine. Mm. But I'm very, very careful, because I don't want to be sharing fake news. I don't want to add to people's confusion. Mm. So with every post that I see, I go back to the source and check the source out. And I think that's important in everything we do.
Absolutely. And often it's not just the source, but the source's source.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. And then I'll Google something and think, is this true first before I start even thinking about posting it?
Absolutely. And going back to kind of, you know, scientists, what's great is they won't tell you if they don't know something. They will tell you if they don't know something. They won't make up something. So
yes,
you know, if I'm going to draw a dinosaur, I want to find somebody that knows as much about that dinosaur as they can. But then they'll be like, well, we don't know what color it was. And I'll be like, oh, great. That means I can make it pink or, you know, brown or purple. It doesn't matter. So it's about getting to a point where you know what it is that you want to kind of create, but accepting that these things that will never be right. And that's okay too.
I got another question for you. So you get the first book published, Deep, right?
Yes.
And now I ask a lot of authors, again, but mainly authors of memoir, this question, which I think kind of applies to you. How do you feel when you put it out there in the world, right? Fiction a little bit differently because you can hide behind the fiction wall. But when you're doing your books and you've got all those peers at the museum, right? You know where I'm going with this.
Yes, I do.
And here's the book and you're super excited. Do you worry? Because often scientists are such perfectionists. Often, I mean, it's those people's jobs to get everything perfectly right and make sure that whatever's in the museum is accurate. And so here you come out with a picture book for children. Do you get nervous about their first response or their response?
A little bit. Yeah, definitely. Like it's
yeah.
natural. And even you know, kids as well. I've been corrected by five-year-olds that know more about dinosaurs than I do. But that's okay because I think if we didn't put it out there in the first place, we'd have nothing to talk about. We wouldn't learn anything from each other. So I kind of... You know, I do everything to make sure that I haven't made mistakes. But if I have, like, I embrace it and say, look, I'm human and I can tell you I worked as hard as I could to get this right. But if things have changed and things do change, history doesn't stay the same. New evidence is found that purple dinosaur might be proven to be a bird instead of a reptile or one and the same. So the ground kind of shifts around too. And I just kind of like that we're here for a certain amount of time and we do the best we can to get it right, knowing that we all have our biases as well and accepting that I'm writing from my privileged point of view and not everybody's writing from that same view. So mistakes are fine, I think.
Yeah, okay. I'd hate to see people coming up to you and saying, well, this isn't right, this isn't right.
That'd just give me an excuse to, you know, write another book about
That's right. I'll correct it in the next one. So if you're working full-time, when is it that you work two jobs? Like how do you approach illustration and writing? Are you a late-night person, early morning person? When does that creativity happen?
A bit of both. And going back to the graphic design element, like you just have to kind of squeeze it in. You can't wait for a perfect Sunday when the sun's shining and it's, you know, 23 degrees, and you can't wait for those windows to open. So you've just got to squeeze it in, you know, before work and after work and on the weekends. And I know that the vast majority of writers would have that other income source because it, you can't really do it. There's people that do, but it's not possible for everybody to do one or the other. So just kind of filling in the cracks, I think, with it is the best way that I've found to do it.
Yeah. And do you find the difference? Like how do you approach writing fiction versus nonfiction? Is that a different headspace for you or a different method or you use the same approach?
I think it's pretty – I think for me it's a bit on a subconscious level they're a bit different. But really it's just telling stories. And it's whether that's based on fact or whether that's based on something that's not fact. It's the same techniques will get a reader to laugh or cry or, you know, take a breath
or be intrigued.
It's the same. There's a lot of overlap, I think, between the genres more than we kind of care to admit because we like putting things in boxes and saying it's fiction or nonfiction or, you know, but I like the ones that are a little bit of both.
Okay, the series is called, well, it's Deep, High, which is out now, and Lost, which is coming. How many books all up have you done?
So for this series, it's just the three, just this lovely trilogy, and Lost is my 10th book.
Yeah, wow.
It's a nice number. So there's a few more coming after that, which I can't talk about just yet, but there's definitely a few more non-fiction ones on the way as well because it gives me such pleasure.
Well, Jess, thank you so much for your time today. It was great to chat.
Thank you so much, Cheryl.
If you'd like more information about Better Reading, follow us on Facebook or visit betterreading.com.au.
This podcast is proudly sponsored by Belinda Audio. Belinda audiobooks are available on CD and MP3 from online booksellers and bookshops everywhere, or you can download from Audible, Google Play, or the iBook Store. We've also created our own app called BorrowBox that's available from both the App Store and Google Play. All you need to do to get it working is to download the app, join your local public library, and you'll gain access to the world's best collection of ebooks and e-audiobooks available for you to loan on your phone or your personal device. Belinda, we're here to enable you to escape, imagine, grow, and be inspired through the power of storytelling. Belinda Audiobooks. Anywhere, everywhere.
Deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
If you enjoyed this podcast, leave us a review and check out the other podcasts on the Better Reading Network.